It's Jaren Blaschke, cinematographer of Nosferatu, and this is the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hey there, Ben Rock. It's time for another episode of the Cinematography Podcast, a podcast where we talk about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image, sponsored by my company, Hot Rod Cameras. How are you today?
Been better.
There's nothing going on in LA, is there?
I hope as by the time this episode drops that the fires will be under control. I'm in an area that I'm in the valley. There was a little concern a couple nights ago about the fire getting into the valley. There have actually been a few fires that broke out in the valley in the middle of the melee, but they were easier to put out. I don't want to say easily put out, but easier to put out than the two big fires, which are the one in the Pacific Palisades, which has destroyed Pacific Palisades, and the Eaton Fire, which has largely destroyed Altadena. And parts of Pasadena, and like neither one of them, as we're recording this, which is Sunday, January 12th, neither one of them is contained. I think that the Palisades one is like 11% contained, and I think that the Altadena one, the last time I checked, I think was like 15% contained. The Eaton Fire, and I personally know, I think 7 or 8 people whose entire homes have been burned to the ground. And, you know, I feel like there's some commentary that's like, screw all those rich people who lost, you know, it's like no one wants everyone to lose everything. But if you think Altadena is a rich enclave, you're wrong. And if you think everyone who lived in the Pacific Palisades was a millionaire, you're wrong. You know, I don't want to name names, but a friend of mine who is a working class film person who just works on film crews rented a 1-bedroom apartment in the Palisades and it's gone.
Yeah, it's terrible and it's heartbreaking, and social media has been really, really good actually about letting the community know about resources that are available, the outpouring of support from local restaurants and local organizations about willing to take on animals or provide resources or give free meals is like it's amazing. It's what I love about LA. I mean, LA does have a certain amount of resilience, and as terrible as this is, probably the worst fire tragedy potentially ever for the city, I have a lot of confidence and faith that the people of Los Angeles are going to rebuild, and they're going to rebuild stronger, and they're going to be even more conscious of fire mitigation practices to try to help the residents of the future not experience what's going through right now. And I think it's going to be painfully aware. You and I were talking just before we started this. We were reminded quite a bit of our conversation with Ron Howard years ago regarding his documentary about Paradise
rebuilding paradise.
There will be rebuilding in Los Angeles, of course. How long it takes and what it looks like, you know, remains to be seen. But I think that the awareness of wildfires and the awareness of how important, you know, look, you know, doesn't really matter where you are on Earth. The environment can conspire to completely obliterate you in many different ways, and fire being one of them. People think that you're in an urban setting that fire may not be a problem. Hate to break it to you, the way that we build structures, the way that weather works, everywhere is always potentially a danger.
And so. I mean, the thing is that the Santa Ana winds were like being in a hurricane. It was like 100-mile-an-hour winds.
Yeah,
trees were blowing over. It was exactly like being in a hurricane with no water. And that's the problem, is we haven't had any rain this year. Like, it's rained for half a day all year, I think, you know, in the last 6 months here. And so everything was dry, and it was just, you know, all it takes is someone to, you know, accidentally drive too close to a curb and create one little spark, you know, with their hubcap, and it, you know, set a little scrub on fire, and the wind just takes it and takes it everywhere.
There's also plenty of blame regarding power lines that weren't de-energized during because they fell and they started fires and stuff.
That's what happened to Paradise.
Yeah, and it seems that's what happened in Los Angeles somewhere too. Someone caught that on camera. So,
oh, interesting. But yeah, I mean, it's surreal being here right now. Like a lot of residents, it's like, I've got suitcases ready to go in the event that, I'm given the evacuation order. Because even though it doesn't look like it's going to hit the valley, that could change. I mean, like, Palisades is a big and affluent place, and it's just freaking gone all the way to, like, Manville Canyon. And, I know someone who lives on Manville Canyon.
I'm getting on an airplane in a few hours, and I'll be flying in when it's dark, so I can tell you what it looks like from my flight here shortly.
I mean, I don't mean to be gross, but take some pictures. I would be interested to see what it looks like from the sky.
I'll be landing in Burbank, so I'm not sure which direction I'm coming in, so I don't know how much I'll be able to see. But regardless, it's definitely a really rough time for everyone, and the repercussions of this are, no one knows exactly what they're going to be yet, but it's going to be a lot. So, Ben, I think that we should probably, though, you and I are not going to add anything to this this conversation.
Agreed.
So we should probably just move right on and get to the interview. Who's on the show today?
Today we have Jaron Blaschke. I could not have been more excited to talk to him. He shot all of Robert Eggers' movies. He's also shot some other really amazing movies, but he's kind of in the way that Bob Yeoman is defined by his relationship with Wes Anderson, I feel like Jaron Blaschke and Robert Eggers have kind of defined each other in a way. And he shot the absolutely beautiful, gorgeous, wonderful, haunting, scary, amazing Nosferatu. And I could not have been more excited to talk to him. I've been wanting to talk to him since I saw The Witch. I love The Witch. His collaborations with Robert Eggers are, definitely they definitely have a stamp. They have a signature, and I have loved all their movies.
I had a quick conversation with Jaron when The Lighthouse came out, but it wasn't for the podcast. It was just I happened to meet him. And I'm really glad that you got to talk to him this time because, he's doing really interesting work and really, really, highly stylized stuff, which is a lot of fun. That's great.
Yeah, I think Nosferatu is one of those movies people are going to reference for years to come. I mean, like, I just love it, but it's not just about me loving it. It's like something that is appreciating film history and is building on it. And, it's just interesting, and it's interesting to hear kind of the process that he and Robert Eggers go through in kind of constructing their work together. And so here's that interview.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
Wow. So, firstly, we're here to talk about Nosferatu, and I just have to say, like, what a freaking triumph. I've been a fan of all the movies you've done with Robert Eggers, especially The Witch, which I could geek out about The Witch all day long. But just such an amazing looking film, such an amazing sounding film, such great performances, such great production design, just a seamless thing. And, usually horror movies don't really have a pile of Oscar buzz around them, but I feel like this year we have two. We've got The Substance and Nosferatu, and I think that you're hopefully both going to get some serious acknowledgement. But I'm going to later want to get into sort of your whole relationship with Robert Eggers, how it started, how it's developed. But like, let's talk first about Nosferatu and like, how is it presented to you? And, when you're talking about a movie, which, is going to be compared to F.W. Murnau's classic, one of the most classic horror movies of all time, one of the original horror movies of all time. And then also there's the Werner Herzog Nosferatu that came out, I think it was in the late 70s.
Yep.
So what's the impetus? And obviously there've been 10 billion versions of Dracula, so it's not like those have to be the only ones, but what was it about this that was specifically grabby to you, your whole team? And like, what new thing did you think you could like bring to Nosferatu?
Yeah, I mean, it's always a, I guess a tug of war between, you know, just trying to do you and not think about too much, you know, and especially when you're doing something like this, you just necessarily have to just put the blinders on and just do your thing, you know. At the same time, you can't deny the baggage either. So, and I do have a contrarian streak in me, you know, like cinematography trend. I'm gonna, you know, that does motivate me somewhat to do something else, but hopefully these two things go hand in hand of, you know, this is, I'm just gonna do my thing, but even further because of whatever, you know. You don't want to be different, but I don't know. It's a fine line. I mean, it all just kind of falls into place when Rob says, you know, it's a romantic movie, right? So the other two Nosferatu movies are not, you know, at least in a visually romantic style. They're both kind of scrappy indies, to be honest, you know. So lighting wise or look wise, you know, we're immediately in the clear. I've seen clips of the Herzog version, but I've never actually seen the version. So, and I've seen them now, however, but that, you know, that's a long time ago, and intentionally I haven't seen it since, because, you know, you think the movie was going to happen. I want to make some distant memory of what the thing is, maybe, or you want to be inspired by memory of it, not literally, you know. You don't want it too fresh, you know. I would like it to be sort of processed and trickle down through the creative aquifer or whatever, you know. So, and then whatever comes out, you know, it's 7 years later or 10 years later, and you know, it's I can at least claim to some extent that it came out of me, but through the whole, you know, everything I've ever watched in my life, you know, that's just a part of it.
So. Well, I'm kind of curious then, like, what were the visual inspirations that kind of fueled it? Are you taking inspiration from an outside source? Are you taking inspiration primarily from Robert Eggers and the script, and kind of going in your own direction? Obviously, it's not a black and white film, but it's got a kind of a desaturated look, and there are scenes that feel monochromatic in it because of the darkness of the lighting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a black and blue scene, essentially, you know?
Yeah.
All of it. I mean, yeah, he says romanticism, and then I get to determine what that means. And we've known each other a long time, and you know, he trusts my tastes at this point, you know? And each film we all trust each other, all the collaborators, you know, like, deeply. So, you know, and if we ever disagree, then, you know, you're going to question yourself at least as much as you're going to question the whoever challenges it, but that doesn't happen very often. So, he says romantic, and I'm thinking of, you know, a massive painting, from the Hudson River School in New York, and Rob's thinking of a German painting by Caspar David Friedrich, and, you know, but it's all kind of the same, or, you know, they're all related. It's all coming from the same spring, really. So,
but like when you say romantic, like, I think about
what does that mean? Right.
Okay. Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula, right? Like they turned the Dracula story into a romance, and they did it by romanticizing Dracula and sexying him up and making him, you know, Gary Oldman and making him attractive. But I have to say that, you know, like, and I don't want to ruin it for anyone who hasn't seen it before, but, you know, like the creature design, like what Orlok looks like in this movie, is a big reveal. But I don't think it's a spoiler to say he's not handsome, hunky Gary Oldman. He is drawn as a monster. Like, yeah, he is
I'm talking about romanticism as an art movement, you know, what does that mean? Well, like, it's a little bit different to everybody. So to me, it just means lush, essentially, you know, but yeah, at its core, it's also, you know, whenever you're faced with a sublime, whatever that means to you, you know, and I got my own experiences and my own outlook, and that's going to feed my version of that. What that, you know, how does that trickle down to to all the little tiny stuff, like how do I expose a negative or, you know, light the scene or, you know, all these little micro decisions, you know, like I get to interpret that. So there's, you know, for example, there's a lot of low light work in the film, you know, when it comes to the candlelight, right? So I want to use real candles. And how do you just eke out a little more dense, you know, not really exposure, it's not technically correct, but you know, how do I just put more on the negative? Well, okay, so can I push the film? All right, so I test that.
Yeah.
You know, I did normal plus half plus one. And then I get a little more density at a plus half, but plus one's too much because to me, whatever, you know, the palette gets too severe. The contrast gets too severe if I push it too much. And then for me, that's less lush and romantic. What, you know, yeah. My version of it, you know, so it's like all these, what lenses give me the palette that gives me this feeling, you know, I mean, you're not going to reproduce a painting. It's a painting, you know, we're making photographs here, but what gives me that feeling? What's, you know, through my particular eyes and my taste. So, you know, so I choose lenses that way, or that, you know, so it's like these thousand little things, you know, and
well, and you chose to shoot on film, and I'm assuming at this point in your collaboration with Robert Eggers, there isn't pushback from anyone around either of you on that kind of a choice. What keeps you coming back to shooting on film?
It looks good.
Do you ever test? I mean, do you ever test it against whatever digital?
I had to. You know, you're around enough, and all your films kind of become tests. You know, mm-hmm. I have all these things. I mean, I also have on my computer. I have folders of. I do a lot of testing for each film as well. You know, because I have to have to do something new each film. Otherwise, you know, like, why are we doing this? You know, if you're just going to regurgitate. So. So I have like folders and folders of tests of, you know, various things. So, and among those, of course, is, you know, like 2016, I tested the Alexa versus 35. Mm-hmm. The money people, you know, shot down film in that case, but that was not a Rob Eggers movie, you know, and it was not, it was a different time, you know? So, but I have that test and, you know, I have memories of all these things and I just know that, you know, I'm just going to get the palette that I want. From film, you know, I want to start with the right thing and then polish that further. I don't want to like arm wrestle something else into something else. So I love the palette. I love the colors. I love, that's really what it's about. I don't do it. Some people, I don't know, there's this, some people just do it because they like grain or something. That's kind of the least interesting thing about film. For me, it's the complexity of the palette and the color. Then, you know, fine. If you want grain, then you have this choice. And if you want less grain, you have this other choice. And you have all this format choices too. So,
well, how much do you move towards like a photochemical finish, or are you doing a lot in like a DI suite?
I mean, the base is pretty straightforward in the, well, it depends on the scene. I mean, our moonlight's getting a little involved. I mean, essentially, this day and age, there has to be a digital version of the movie, and that is just going to be the predominant way people watch the movie.
Yeah,
it's inescapable. What that does, it still makes shooting film very worthwhile. You know, I mean, the best color color you're going to get in the world is a contact printed 35 millimeter negative, but you know, you don't have the control, right? So it's just like, it's like, yeah, basic RGB, you know?
Yeah.
And density. So there you go. The end. But what I get to do digitally is dodge and burn like you would in a darkroom, which is a, you know, massive tool, you know, and if you know how to do it, they're bad ways to do things and good ways to do things. And, you know, I think I found a way for myself that I think it, you don't notice it at all. And it simply, like, it's just that extra perfect seasoning after you've done all the work, you know, with your recipe. So it's, it's just stuff like landscapes. Okay, how do I draw the eye where I want to draw the eye? And we're shooting an overcast landscape, you know?
Yeah.
And it should be overcast because that's the tone of the scene. It should be bleak, but like, I want these clouds to be quote unquote romantic. What does that mean to me? Well, they need to have a little drama. You know, again, this overall feeling that I get to guide all my decisions, you know? So, okay, so I do have this dark cloud over here. Let's make that a little darker and let's make the light a little lighter. Let's add, you know, let's emphasize what's already there. there's kind of maybe a perception that power windows and dodging and burning is like fixing things, but it's not at all. It's you know, it's polish, you know. So there's a limit, unless you're doing an entire movie of close-ups, you know, there's only so much control you can have. So you just like lay a nice baseline on your negative, and you do it with extreme care and as tediously as they'll allow, you know, and then you get to go further in post, you know, so that takes you to new heights again. So
are you finding the color palette though, in the way that you're lensing and lighting it? Cause I really feel like this movie has such a striking use of color and lack of color. Where it makes sense, is how much of that is achieved in the DI, or is that something that
it's everything baked together. I mean, your lenses will affect your color too, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, for example, there's a very, I don't know, these are still trendy, but you know, there's like a trendy, people were shooting these Canon K35 lenses that have, you know, I don't know why they were trendy, because they deliver the flattest color. Like, it's just not a dimensional image, it's just sort of like a skin tone, to kind of becomes a, it's hard to describe, there's just no depth to the variations of tone and color in a shot, you know. And
yeah,
so but that's one additional dimension of how you choose lenses, is like, you know, yeah, it's overall contrast, you know. Do you like your highlights to, do you like a little astigmatism for your highlights to glow? Do you like the bokeh? Do you like the micro contrast? Do you like, how much texture do you want a skin tone? How much pore do you want to see? Whatever, you know?
Yeah.
And depending on the film, you know, that'll guide that. But yeah, a lot of it's the color depth too. So that's partially chosen in the optics. It's the grade, it's the film stock, it's who scans it, and who you're, and not only that, not only, you know, the machine, but like who's doing it and what are the settings.
Well, like, well, so how into that process do you get? Do you like sit down with them, with the people who are handling this? Cause I assume you're making the movie, you don't have time to be supervising the scanning. Like,
that's why prep is vital. You know, I mean, that's why I was there for 5 months of prep. So yeah, part of that prep is, you know, finding out the gel recipe for Moonlight, you know, filters, what sort of lighting ratios do I want to use? I had high speed lenses made. How do they look? Oh, they're a little smushy over there, or, you know, or whatever, or I'm not, the focus field is not matching our primary set. Can you adjust the lenses? So, you know, this movie, we had such a long prep that we could go, you know, and really hone things. Like I don't get to do for any other filmmaker, you know, because it's just part of the deal to understand that I'm going to have a longer, you know, I'm not going to get the standard 8 weeks prep. I'm going to be there from when we start storyboarding, which is so, yeah. So scanning, you just test that like anything else, like you do your lighting or your lenses or anything. So
yeah, it's very complicated. Well, so when I was watching this, I was thinking a little bit about, Anastas Mikos, who we've had on the show, and him talking about shooting with intention. And it was something that like really kind of stuck in my head about, you know, there's the far opposite side of it would be like a Paul Greengrass way, where it feels all documentary style and, you know, you're getting little snippets of this or that. And like, this is one of those movies where like every shot feels like, you know, you would hang it on your wall, like, and every shot feels designed, intentional, like, we're not just following characters. We're telling a story with these characters. You're telling the visual story. And it started making me wonder about, like, when you talk about like the storyboarding process, the pre-production process, like, how did you go about, like, it, I mean, you know, there are scenes in any movie that have like coverage, you know, shot, right, reverse shot, whatever. But I feel like this had, you know, it had vibes of people like Guillermo del Toro and stuff like that, where it felt like, there were a lot of scenes. There was only one way that scene was going together. Like, it was made to be like that. And there were camera moves that I thought were kind of mind bending. There was one that kind of goes over, I don't want to ruin the moment, but it goes over the bed and kind of tilts down while people are on a bed. And I mean, like in the theater, it just like bent my mind. And I'm wondering like, where do the inspirations for that come from? And like, how do you and Robert Eggers kind of put this stuff together? Cause you know, even The Witch feels not documentary like, but feels, should I say looser?
Compositionally.
Well, at the time, I thought it was very careful composition. Yeah. It is.
I watched it recently
because I had to put together a talk about whatever, you know, at Cameron Image, and I was like, oh, actually, there's just a lot of. I felt like a loosey-goosey movie now, you know, because it feels like it to the extreme. So
what I love about one of the many bajillion things I love about that movie is I feel like a fly on the wall in a culture that happened in my country that is nothing like my culture. And so I'm seeing like real behavior. So it feels very not fly on the wall like a Paul Greengrass movie, but it feels like it's showing it kind of like it was. It's so well done. But this I feel is just a deeply controlled from a point of view standpoint.
Yeah, and if it feels claustrophobic, then let's lean into that. You know. If you feel controlled, I mean, this is about a vampire. You know. Dirty control over Ellen and everyone else. You know. So, hopefully, there's a good deal of discomfort in.
Oh yeah.
You know, even though it's a conventional camera move, it's just. There's an actor, they're going over there. It's going to pan, but like how you pan and how you land and when you pan and what's the, you know, the feeling of it and how you conduct the camera operator to execute that pan, you know, that gives you in itself a lot, you know? So yeah, it's always trying to play with audience expectation, even down to that level, even when it is a, you know, simple like pan down the hallway, you know, to the.
Well, but I noticed that kind of work happening a lot, and it reminded me, it was like, it's a radically different effect, but like Bob Yeoman and Wes Anderson do that a lot, where they would establish something and then kind of pan over to something else as a juxtaposition, whereas another filmmaker would just probably cut to that thing, but you're tying them together. And, you know, in the case of Wes Anderson, a lot of times it's to be funny or to make a funny juxtaposition. And in this, it was often to make us either more claustrophobic, more uncomfortable, or raise the stakes or the horror or whatever of it. But I actually did think about, it was making me think about sort of Bob Yeoman and Wes Anderson's, the intentionality of the camera. I kept returning to that thought.
Yeah, he obviously designs those movies, you know, highly, and to me, they feel like illustrations, you know, in a good way, which is kind of what we're doing, you know. So it's very storybook, which I didn't shoot the movie every day, like, oh, all right, we're making a storybook. But now that I've seen it enough times, like, oh yeah, we made a storybook. So that's cool, you know, because that was like one of the first things that Rob and I bonded over when we met, you know, in 2007 at a tea joint in Williamsburg that's no longer there. Is, you know, we bonded over the golden age of illustration, you know, and we're both that sort of fairy tale storybook thing, you know, and it's interesting to kind of take it. We finished this movie a year and a half ago, and you know, now that I watch it, like I see that I get to be outside of it enough to where I can see, you know, that that love of, you know, children's illustration from the you know.
So like if you could you know, kind of take me into the world of how the two of you guys collaborate when you're prepping, you know, to do the shoot, like how involved is it? Mostly him working with the storyboard artist? Is he doing the boards, or are the two of you kind of going over how you're going to construct the scene, how you're going to shoot it, you know, the angles, the lenses, the lighting, all that good stuff?
So in this, the last three movies, well, no, I guess it's just the last two that we storyboarded the whole movie. The Lighthouse is really a very verbose shot list. And then we graduated to storyboards in The Northman. But yeah, this latest time, I mean, Northman had a lot of prep too. It was even more than we bargained for because of COVID, right? So we kind of went down, and then, you know, I got on like the last flight back to America, you know, and then I had this like quarantined, but, and then I was like in an Airbnb in Berkeley, you know, waiting for 2 weeks so I can go back to my daughter, you know, and then coming up with storyboard ideas, you know. We had all this time, but Nosferatu, for example, I arrived, you know, we arrived in September, around September 1st, Our kids begin school there, and the production office isn't even open yet. I think it was like a month or 6 weeks. So bus picks up my daughter. Then I go to Rob's house. He makes his espresso. I make my Chinese tea, and we just kind of chill and not chill as in not work, as in, it's just the perfect atmosphere to be relaxed and inspired, because that's not what it's going to be on set, so that is a very strong part of the argument to, design your movie beforehand. It's because the ideas that you come up with, over the course of 4 months, as opposed to 4 minutes, the 4 months is going to win every time, and the
Yeah.
environment's much, much better, and then you get to revise it and, think about it. So, maybe you just want to react to things like, if we want to go back to Paul Greengrass or Hardwick or whomever, you can do that, but I don't know. I want the audience to get what they're not expecting. Like, if I'm just reacting to stuff in the moment, I'm going to go for the easiest automatic thing. And that's what I've seen recently. That's kind of the knee jerk thing. But if I have time to come up with an idea and think about how to surprise people, that's a lot more fun, So yeah, so we show up, we do this for a few, we just talk about the scene. It's kind of like we do it in the order of what's inspiring and most interesting, what comes to us, first. And, then I'll draw some thumbnails, and they're, usually about whatever that is. If it's early in prep, they're nice and big and detailed. Not big, but whatever. They're 4 inches wide, and then, right before shooting, and we're still boarding, they're like 1 inches wide, and then, we'll work out.
So you draw the boards.
Yeah, sometimes they're good and sometimes they're really scrappy, and then they go to the storyboard artist,
Oh, okay. So they're sent off. Well, because like I know, I looked into your background and you went to the School of Visual Arts, and I know that they are, as the name would imply, SVA.
I'm not an amazing artist by any stretch, but I'm better than the average person, and I can actually draw. I can My brain can process, three dimensions and convey it into a, two dimensional. You understand space pretty well, and I can approximate a focal length, of a lens. But yeah, I'm no artist.
But that's cool though, that basically, so when we see kind of the visual, when we consider the visual construction of these scenes, it's sort of this collaboration that came out of the two of you kind alone kind of
Yeah, ba bashing stuff
bashing it
out.
out.
Yeah. And then it's like, then we have an idea, like verbally, and then he'll, have to get on the phone with an actor or producer, or, go over extras casting, or, the art department or whatever. And then, I'll draw it out. And in the process of drawing it out, then you run into your first round of problems, right? It was great in your head. And that's like, oh, actually, this cut doesn't work because, we're going right to left, and it'd be better if the next shot was also right to left, or maybe, the opposite, or et cetera. And sometimes there's a lot of questions, and if he's still occupied because he's the director and he's doing a million things, then I'll just draw out three different, what do you call it? Three options, three waterfalls of how the shot can progress. And they're like, which one do you think is better? And I'll say, well, I think this one's better because I get this. And, this one's better because of that. Which do you, what's the priority? Or maybe he has some other thing. It's like, well, I'm missing this, and maybe his instinct is to add a shot, but then my instinct is to not. So then I try to get what he wants in the existing structure, and sometimes you can kind of play it around, move it around like a Rubik's Cube and figure it out. Sometimes you can't.
No, that's really cool though. Because like and this movie also kind of made me think a little bit of, I don't know if you saw last year a movie called El Conde that came out that
Not in full.
Ed Lochman shot. Yeah. I
Yeah,
mean
I'm aware of it.
that's mostly black and white, but there are shots of the main vampire flying that it's not the same, but like there's a couple of signature shots in this movie that felt like that or felt like maybe a direct nod to German expressionism, which were, like it's one of them's in the trailer. It's the Nosferatu hand kind of reaching over the city. But then you repeat that motif a few times where we almost see his shadow more than we more of him more of his shadow than we see of him early in the film. And I was wondering if that was kind of a nod to sort of the roots of Nosferatu. Even though you didn't go back and rewatch the movie. the original.
Yeah, I mean, look, Rob will watch and rewatch this stuff. He's very comfortable with that. I have this instinct to protect my naivete, you know. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's either partially or highly in the face of Rob's like being so studied, you know,
in history
that I like to, I guess, bring the other, you know. So all the shadow work really is in the script. You know, it describes these shots. So
oh, really?
Yeah. It's all there. It's not like we're gonna come add a shadow or it's not, you know, in the script. And so yeah, I'm just doing what I'm told there. Like, where's the camera and what's the perspective and how do we merge the shadow into the next shot? You know.
Well, how did you cast the shadow over the whole city? I'm assuming that wasn't a visual effects shot. I'm assuming that was practically done somehow.
No, that's a visual effect shot.
It is?
Yeah. What's cool about this movie is that I got to be there for the VFX work, you know, which is usually farmed out, you know.
Yeah.
But after The Northman, which is our first big effects movie, you know, there's a lot of stuff that I wish I could have changed, but I wasn't really involved until it was like time to grade the movie. And at that point, it's too late to change anything. You know, it's like even like mats, like, oh, this is your background. And I'm trying to match a foreground to a background on a, you know, on a green screen boat, and can you change the background plate? Well, then the mats break and you have these weird edges and we don't have time for that. This background has to be at this density and it, you know, doesn't. Anyway, I learned a lot of stuff. So this time, you know, Rob could get in there and make a case for me being involved and actually direct the lighting of all these VFX shots. So that's, because rather than someone just sort of putting us, for example, a softbox moonlight on the castle, which is the first drafts of the castle work, you know, maybe the end result would have been something similar to that had I not been involved. But I was like, you know, I could direct it like I was a gaffer, you know. So, yeah, put the source here. It's too soft. Make it harder. No, not hard enough. Go again, you know. And then, oh, okay, so now I'm seeing where the shadows fall. Can you move it a little higher? You know, set your fill light at this level, but slightly toppy. You can go into great detail when you're actually involved, you know. So hopefully that stuff sits in with the practical lighting better than you can see sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, like, I was wondering, and also maybe, like, I have stories from The Witch floating around in my head. Like, you know, I've heard that on The Witch that the farmhouse was made out of the wood from the woods nearby where you shot, and basically,
well, I don't know about that, but maybe. I don't
know. That's what I heard. What I heard about The Witch was really the only major liberty that was taken was the windows in the house were made larger so you could get more light in into there, because the actual windows historically would have been like slits and there'd be no indoor light.
Yeah, and we have more windows than they would have had. You know, maybe they would have had one or two windows. We had, you know, three or four. So,
but like, I guess, like, in my mind, it's like, okay, so purist, and you know, watching Nosferatu, it's obvious, it's evident that there's probably some VFX work going on in it, but it's really hard to see where it is. Like, when you say green screen, I assume it's, you know, stuff on the boat. Well, I'm sure that there's some green screen stuff throughout, but none of it like draws any green screeny attention to it.
Angela, I did a Q&A with Angela, who's the VFX supervisor, and, you know, she answered a question. She said 80% of the shots have some VFX work.
Oh, wow.
You know what I mean? So is it, do you do it with care and taste? You know, I guess that's what it comes down to. You know, a lot of it's just, you know, again, you're just like burning and dodging. You're doing it to emphasize, you know, it's there and you're just making it, you know, it's a polished sort of thing.
Well, I can imagine, like, if you're looking down at the street and it's easier to add scurrying rats composited in post than it would be to try and get them to scurry exactly the way you needed them to in that shot.
You also have, you know, animal welfare and all kinds of variables.
Yeah.
You know, it's not even like easier. It's just like the law, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
well, yeah, you've got wolves, you've got rats, you've got a cat, you know?
Yeah. You know, to fill that chapel at the end, probably 30,000 rats, honestly. Yeah. You know, 5,000 sounds like a lot, but it rats, you know, a lot goes a little way, you know. So so where are you gonna get 30,000 rats, and where are you gonna get it within a time frame?
The New York City subway system is the answer.
And yeah, well, actually one rat is like three elsewhere, so yeah, totally. Or six, they're badgers and, you know, in other places, so I lived in New York. I know all about it. So, yeah.
Well, that's interesting because I feel like, you know, there's the there are plenty of movies that have obvious visual effects, and then there's movies that kind of have invisible visual effects. And my guess is probably if I saw a VFX breakdown of a lot of the stuff, I mean, if you're like adding a digital mat to extend a wall or something like that, kind of stuff is easy to miss. But, what were some of the VFX things going in that you were like, are we going to be able to pull it off? And, you know, what did you do to pull them off?
So, I mean, other examples would be, you know, the city street. Okay, we can build 2 to 3 stories of the buildings. Well, the ones, you know, near us where the camera tends to be near, you don't need them as high because you're not going to see as high because it's closer. You know, it's just emergence of lines, you know, easy. That makes sense. But, you know, in the distance. But anyway, you have limits, right? So you have to top up these buildings. You know, there's a chapel that you want to establish down the way. I still have to be careful. Like, I need the shadows to fall like the buildings are taller. So even though I'm not building it, I got to put in a case to just put gray. They did it in fabric. In the future, I'd love to do it with just like, you know, plywood, you know, but then you're up on a hill and then you have wind and all the stuff. But like if you have an open street and the light's just sort of, you know, if it's the light of the Great Plains, but you're in a city street, you have a problem, you know. So that's like that's a case I got to make. Anyway, that's one VFX thing that you're doing, you know. The vampire blood coming out of his eyes. Okay, that's obviously VFX. You know, we're in a fortunate position where they give us plenty of time to like go through several iterations of this. You know, they sent me the boat on the water. You know, they had a version of that. They were okay with it, and I saw it, and I was like, well, obviously this dawn sky was shot. This is stock footage shot in HD. This is not good enough. And they're like, well, we can't find, you know, stock footage in, you know, on film. We've been looking for 2 months, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh, well, we got to figure something out, you know.
Can you just take your 35 millimeter camera out and shoot some actual
I shot stuff on my iPhone and I was like, yeah. Do you see all the variation of color and tone and blah, 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 you know, because like the sun is like the rare sunny day in London. And I just went, you know, took a picture out the window.
Yeah.
You can get this. So anyway, that was a little mean, but, you know, but you just have to. With time and care, you can do this. Ultimately, I went to like Flickr, which is a website of photography online. It used to be cooler than it, you know, or more popular than it is now. And I just did a search for dawn skies, you know, and there's a guy in Australia, a dentist shooting panoramic, you know, within a panoramic medium format camera of, you know, ocean at dawn, you know. So they just crop out the rocks and all that stuff. But then that became, you know, there's a dentist in Australia who shot our dawn shot of the boat.
Oh, wow.
You know, he's doing fine in his practice. He's like having it scanned at the local lab and, you know, hunting down the negatives. And he was very helpful. If I'd remember his name, I'd say it right now. He was very helpful.
That's amazing, though. That's amazing that you know, that, I mean, I guess it's just great that we live in a time where that's achievable, yeah, sure. You know?
Yeah. He had to go back and find the negative from, you know, 15 years ago. And he did, you know, and scanned it on a drum scanner and sent it over. And then they had to sort of rush to fit that into the movie, but it worked out.
Cool. Let's back up a little bit and just kind of talk about like how you mentioned a little bit earlier, but like how you and Robert Eggers started your collaboration. I don't mean to make it totally the Robert Eggers love fest. You know, you've worked with M. Night Shyamalan. You've done a lot of work, but you know, I sort of feel like in kind of the Bob Yeoman, Wes Anderson world, like you and Robert Eggers are almost synonymous with each other as filmmakers.
We can be straightforward. This is my primary collaboration, you know, and I can't wait to find my other one, you know, but I just don't, this is the best deal you can imagine, you know, like I'm brought on so early. I'm following through to the end with VFX there's a culture of wonderful OCD among everybody, like, you know, and being a perfectionist is encouraged, not, you know, sneered at. I mean, first 15 years of my career, it's, you know, that's seen as a defect, you know, perfectionism. So to find, you know, when you finally get there, it's like revelatory, you know, so I don't expect to find that collaborator, you know, every year. So fair enough. Yeah, I mean, I met. What was the question?
How the two of you met, how you started collaborating. Because I mean, like again, The Witch. I'm a giant horror nerd, and The Witch is one of those movies that I had been hearing about for a long time, and I couldn't wait to see it. And I saw it twice in the theater. I don't buy a lot of Blu-rays. Bought the Blu-ray. I've watched it several times. I wish my son was old enough to show it to. I never want to make this stuff about me, but I had worked on the original Blair Witch Project, and the sequel that the two guys who wrote and directed the original Blair Witch Project, what they wanted to do back in 2000 was a lot like what The Witch was. I mean, I would flatter any of us to say that we could have made anything that great. But available light feeling, like just kind of that claustrophobia in the open space, colonial era story was sort of the idea that they had pitched, and was immediately like nobody wanted it. They wanted a modern day movie with young kids and video cameras in the woods again. And they made it, and it didn't do very well. But I went into that movie with a special interest in like how'd they pull it off. And to me, it, like, pound for pound has one of the most disturbing images I've ever seen in a movie, which was when the mother wakes up from the dream with the crow. Right. Kind of pecking at her. Holy crap. Like, it gives me goosebumps to even think about it.
The raven was supposed to be suckling, but yeah, ravens don't suckle. So, you know,
well, close enough.
Yeah. Supposed to be breastfeeding the raven.
But that, like to me, that felt like a Hieronymus Bosch paint drawing brought to life. Like, it was just like hair raisingly creepy. And just so well done and so unexpected, Black Phillip, the whole thing. So like, Robert Eggers hadn't made a movie at that point. You'd been working, but like, how did you guys realize like, oh yeah, we're the team to make this specific kind of movie? Cause you've made, I can't imagine you guys, maybe you will one day. I can't imagine you making like a modern day rom-com. Like, you guys have only made like really dark, moody period pieces.
Yeah. I mean, he wants to go on a trip, you know?
Yeah.
When he's watching he doesn't love to watch his work like anybody, but you know, when you watch, in making the movie, he wants to go on a trip, you know?
Yeah.
So do I. You know, a trip through space and time and culture, and you know,
yeah,
that's he can just walk out the front door as far as he's concerned. You know, if he wanted to do a contemporary movie, not interesting to him. Could he do a sci-fi that he likes? That'd be an interesting idea. You know, we'll see. But yeah, essentially.
But like, what was the meeting of minds when you guys
he hired me for a short film. You know,
oh okay,
like in 2007. So we're both just scrubby, dirty hipsters in Williamsburg, you know, at that time. So, I'm sleeping on a friend's couch. Rob's doing street theater and waiting tables. And, you know, and yeah, he made a short film called, you know, Hansel and Gretel. Mm-hmm. Mom's in it as the witch, I think. He shot it himself, you know, video, kind of handheld black and white video of Hansel and Gretel, kind of through a wide angle lens. Horrifically to him, I'm sure you could find it online. And so he wanted to hire someone for a second one, and someone was recommended to him who was a member of a, you know, kind of a small New York below the line agency. I don't know how he, anyway, so he went online and, you know, watched the work. He didn't like it. But there are also probably another 15, 20 people on that same website. I have a Prussian last name. What does that look like? You know, so just because that, he click, you know, utterly superficial, clicks my name. Apparently he liked it, you know, emails me. And yeah, we meet and to shoot The Telltale Heart, which is second short film. You know, his family and friends pony up for 16mm, and we do this like kind of a dollhouse of a movie. Version of Telltale Heart. And, you know, I read it and I thought it was going to be, you know, or I got this email. I'm like, oh, how adorable, this, you know, film student, whatever. Turns out he's never been to film school. He's been to acting school and, you know, he's essentially self-taught, complete self-taught aesthetically. And, you know, so, dramatically, but yeah, so we meet and we connect, like I said, over, fairy tale illustration, certain kinds of photography, you know, you name it. So then we shoot that thing, and then it takes them 7 years to get The Witch made. So, but we're just like, in the meantime, we're just hanging out, you know, and sharing, you know, advice. Think something is cool and he should see it and he should like, you know, and he like, he, it's, he, if I think it's something he would like, I'll send it to him. And it's just kind of a, like hanging out. It's just an exchange of aesthetic ideas for 7 years as well, you know?
Excellent. So do you guys know what you're going to collaborate on next?
Oh, like as of right now?
Yeah.
There's, I mean, he always has four things or more, you know, on four burners going on the stove. So, and some are written, some are not, some have a polish, some are just, you know, two things that are ready now, but you know, which one are they going to go for and what's the circumstance of how it's made and who's the cast and are they available and all the other stuff that needs to be sorted. Obviously I can't give you any other
information. No intel,
but yeah, I wish, of course not, but
Well, hopefully we can have you back at some point because I'd love to get into The Lighthouse and The Northman. Sure. But, you know, obviously we're here to talk about Nosferatu. Thank you so much for coming on. If people are looking for your work online, where can they find it? Obviously, I want everyone who's hearing the sound of my voice to go see Nosferatu, preferably in the biggest, loudest theater you can find. But where can people find, you know, do you have a website or Instagram?
Oh,
or?
I have a very outdated website, you know. Mm. I think the last I updated was like The Lighthouse, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
As we're going to award season. I got to do that, but I don't know. I mean, I'm lucky enough that movies I've shot, you know, can be found. But I do have photography up on that website. I mentioned Flickr, actually, going back, you know, 20 years. That's how I know about it, you know, because I just whenever I could get access to a scanner, I just put some stuff up on there. So, but yeah, I need to get my photography up there at least. Meanwhile,
oh, cool. Sorry, good.
Meanwhile, it's Flickr. You know, I need to.
Well, I mean, Flickr's worth it. We can link to Flickr and people can check out your work. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. And again, everybody go see Nosferatu. I personally, it will surprise nobody who knows me that I just love this movie, and I'll definitely be seeing it a few more times. But thanks for coming on.
No problem.
All right, so that was Jaron Blasky. Hey, thank you so much for being on the show. It was great having you on to chat about Nosferatu. I hope you come back when your next movie drops.
Yeah. So, Eggers or no, we'll have you back anytime.
So Ben, it is time for us to pay the bills. We got to thank our fine friends over at Arri, makers of all kinds of cameras, lenses, lighting. We got to talk about the Alexa 35, which, you know, look, it came out now almost 2 years ago. Not quite, but a year and a half ago, really solidly, maybe even a little bit more. And it was shipping in small quantities. But and now it, I want to say it's basically ubiquitous. It's all over the industry. But it has done some really, really amazing stuff, and arguably the best camera, most accessible, you know, best top level, top tier camera in the world. It is being used on all kinds of productions, including I just happened to watch the behind the scenes of Squid Game Season 2.
Oh, wow.
Clearly saw Alexa 35 and some of the BTS, which did not surprise me at all. The show looks fantastic. But the Alexa 35 is this workhorse camera, which is not too big, doesn't have too much power consumption, makes incredible images, incredible dynamic range. If you are in the market for a new camera and you have the budget, the high-end budget, then the Alexa 35 has to be on your list, along with all of the other sort of top players. But the Alexa 35 really has the infrastructure and really has the prowess with post-production. And wherever you go, you're going to be able to find Alexa 35 accessories. That camera is now all around the world, and it is being used every day by professionals. It's absolutely worth considering the Alexa 35 if you are in the market in 2025 for a brand new high-end professional digital cinema camera. So check it out. You can find them, of course, over at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com. We keep that camera in stock. And we've got a demo in our Los Angeles showroom, so you can come play with it and check it out and see if it's for you.
I think Gary might be going places. I think that company might work out.
Yeah, I think so too.
And now, Short Ends.
So Ben, it is our short end time of the show. It's the time we talk about our pet obsessions. It's a thing that we are all about this week. Could be anything. What is your short end for this week in January 2025?
Well, I mean, you know, my real short end is don't let myself or anyone I know die in a fire. But failing that, the thing that has diverted me from abject terror is a new special on Netflix from Philomena Kunk called Kunk on Life. Mm-hmm. And if you're not familiar with Philomena Kunk, it's this woman who does like a BBC style kind of dry documentary. Like, we've all seen super well made, amazing BBC documentaries, right? And it's presented in every way like that. And her name is Diane Morgan, by the way. And she kind of has, I don't know the geography of England well enough, but she has kind of a flat country-ish accent. Like, she's not, what do they call it? You know, like the Shakespearean kind of pronunciation. It's not very proper. I've seen interviews with her and she's like, I'm not very posh. And it's a lot like a Borat or a Bruno kind of a thing, but it's so subtle. And she gets these like serious experts in whatever their field is and sits them down in a very formal looking interview and then just asks them either like not stupid, but just way out questions. And it's just hilarious. And she's been doing this, I think, now for like 10 years. So there was a series that's also on Netflix called Kunk on Earth. If you like this, definitely check out Kunk on Earth. She has a weird obsession with the 90s song Pump Up the Jams. That she works into every episode. And in this one, too, there's like some fake commercials and stuff that they made as well. And it's just hilariously funny. And, you know, as a fake documentarian myself, I can appreciate the game of someone who has tackled, like, let's make the most high production value, walking around the earth, drone shots circling you while you're standing on a mountaintop, and then punch into an extreme close-up of some, you know, some random piece of artwork. There's a bit that she does where she's looking at a Van Gogh painting of crows in a wheat field and just tears it to shit and is like, obviously Van Gogh did not know how to paint. Look at these crows. They don't even look like crows. Some of them don't even have two wings. Some of them have four wings. The brush strokes look like he was wearing a boxing glove while he was doing it. Like, you know, he was a terrible painter and should never have done it. And then like after, and she's delivering this all to camera, and then she's like, what do you think? And the camera pans over to the art expert who's watched her say all this. And he's just like without words. And I'm not doing it justice. Any way I try and describe it won't work. If you have Netflix, check out Kunk on Life. You can also find a bunch of her videos on YouTube. It's from the BBC. So it's like the BBC making fun of themselves. It's like the Onion level humor. It's so good. And yeah, check it out.
Yeah, I agree. It's a great show. I watched most of Kunk on Life and so many good laughs. So many good laughs. It's absolutely worth checking out.
She's an amazing, she is so good at this. Like, I feel like it's somewhere between Stephen Colbert and Sacha Baron Cohen, but more subtle. Like,
agreed.
If you turned off the sound, you would have no idea.
Yeah,
she's not a big weird character. She just comes across like a very genuine person.
There's a bit of BBC deadpan in her delivery, which is just so spot on. I love it. It's really good.
Anyway, what about yourself, Ilya? What is your pet obsession this week?
CES 2025. I'm not going to come out and say that like CES 2025 is dead. And for those of you who are not familiar with CES, it is the Consumer Electronics Show. It happens every January in Vegas. And the reason it is my short end this week is how unremarkable it really was. I think that it's and sometimes CES 2025 is unremarkable in one particular area or another. And this year it seemed like there was a lot of, you know, unremarkability about it. I don't think the convention is going away. Sometimes it just doesn't fit in the product release cycle for major manufacturers, but there's some interesting hauls that go on there. I didn't go to it, so I had to get reports this year from other people who went and from the usual sort of press and trade talking about CES 2025. But the innovation seems to be very much an incremental year, where it wasn't a lot of like standout things that are going to completely revolutionize your life. Now, there was, of course, probably the thing that got the most attention was a Roomba that will pick up your sock. I don't know how big a deal this really is for some people out there, but those, I guess, really into Roombas, there's a Roomba that will pick up your socks.
The sock Roomba.
The sock Roomba. And then it's not made by Roomba, it's made by another company, but it's got a robot arm that comes out. So robots were everywhere. Robots was definitely a theme. But yes, the robots that pick up socks, robots that do other various things. There was an electric spoon that will heat your soup for you, I guess.
What?
There's
it sounds like a whole lot of solutions in search of a problem. Like, oh man, I wish that I could only put a scalding spoon into my mouth that would heat itself.
Yes, there was all kinds of stuff like that, but in the area of cameras,
it's like the dad from Gremlins took over CES this year.
there was all kinds of stuff that were of questionable value. The big camera manufacturers didn't have big announcements, and usually most of the big camera manufacturers have sort of a consumer division, and they kind of have new consumer products. And yes, there was some of that that went on.
Okay, but let me ask you about this. Yeah. Consumer cameras have been destroyed by smartphones, have they not?
No, I would say.
What are you doing with a consumer camera anyway?
Well, I'm going to put that cameras sort of like the FX3, like they sit in this sort of like high end of the consumer.
Well, that's like prosumer. That's like someone who's like a photographer hobbyist or a filmmaker or somebody like that.
Nikon, Fuji, all of them have this sort of like, you know.
But there used to be point and shoot cameras that a Jamoke would go to Best Buy and buy for $300. That was like a camera. I can't imagine why anyone would buy one of those if they own a smartphone.
You know, there's actually a couple of people who are getting them now, and there are certain reasons why you might want it. I think I saw Panasonic actually has a new one that they just announced. So, but you know, Nikon, Fuji, all of them sort of have cameras at that level. There is perfectly good reasons not to use your smartphone, but smartphones are so convenient, so they have destroyed what is That's considered the point and shoot and even the bridge camera market. I do not see smartphones destroying more professional photography.
No, I agree. But I agree. Like if you're a real photographer I'm not saying a real photographer couldn't take a great picture with their smartphone, but like you're going to have a real camera.
So getting back to CES though, there was one thing I saw that was really, really interesting from the news reports, not from me personally being there, that I thought could be a real game changer. And it's called the Smart Cane 2. So you might know that CES covers, automotive and home tech and, of course, accessibility tech. And one of these things is it's a company called WeWalk, and it's the Smart Cane 2. And it's an AI-enhanced cane for people who are blind. And essentially, it has navigation and other sort of smart features built into the cane. So you don't have to, like, be using a cell phone and also trying to do other stuff while you're walking down the street. The cane will be able to sense different things and then also tell you which way you're going, which I got to say, like, that just sounds like a huge boon for the, visually challenged community out there. It seems pretty amazing. It folds up. It's rechargeable. It's CES is incredibly diverse in all of the products and stuff they show. I also think that, home battery, electric backups are going to be more and more of a thing, especially as prices come down and capacity increases. So there are a few sort of trends that you can see coming out of CES, but this is not a cinematography related thing at all. However, I do often look at the trends and see how those trends might inform other technology that does get used in cinema space. So if you're seeing GPS navigation added to a cane, it is not surprising to me that perhaps you'll see GPS navigation actually added into cameras, not necessarily for the purpose that you might think of, how do I get from point A to point B, but actually tracking movement as metadata inside of the camera. Back when I worked at DALSA years ago, we talked about doing this because we made some GPS trackers that were really, really accurate. They were accurate to 3 centimeters in X, Y, and Z space anywhere on Earth, which was incredible. And one of the things we talked about is, How we could have all that metadata just burned straight into the camera so that VFX people would know exactly the camera height and would know exactly, yeah,
relative positions. I'm sure that they're not doing this, but like lighting would benefit from that as well. If like basically once you had a lighting setup, you just, you know, pressed a button saying, that's my setup. That would not just help with VFX to say like, okay, we can rebuild. We know exactly where the lights are, how they're lensed, what color temperature each one of them are at, like everything, because if you're dropping new things in there, you could just create a virtual lighting. But also, and it happens all the time where it's like you shoot something and you have to do a pickup and you have to reset the lighting to look the way it did. If the lights could just tell you, okay, over here, dingus, you know, up 7 more inches, pan to the right.
It also wouldn't surprise me if we start seeing some other technology involving like battery power, because like the fact that batteries are getting more efficient and they're getting less expensive and smaller, I think you're going to see a lot more batteries on sets. I think you're going to see a lot more batteries powering things that that were previously only AC powered. So,
and maybe movies that are made in places where you couldn't get a generator in for some reason, but you could bring your own battery power. Yeah, I mean, to me, like,
you can roll them in like coolers. Yeah, you don't have to have a giant generator the way you see. You could literally be like rolling in your Yeti cooler, except it's batteries, and then
Crawford generator is like it's a whole thing. I mean, you know, I hate to see Jenny operators go out of work, but
I think Jenny operators are going to switch to batteries. I think that's the reality. I think that's what's happening in the future here. And even somewhat today, there is some systems that are already out there that people are using. They just, they haven't proliferated the way that, that they're ubiquitous as of yet, but it will be, I think, coming like a freight train. So yeah, the days of the Jenny are probably numbered. All right. So Ben, I think that just about does it for this episode. Where can people find you if they want to track you down?
You can find me at benrock.com. That's where you'll find all my socials, although I guess they don't have Blue Sky on there. So you can find me at Blue Sky, Neptune Salad at Blue Sky.
I guess that means you gotta get on that. You gotta update your website, add Blue Sky.
No. Squarespace doesn't have like the link for that yet.
Gotcha.
Like they have like the social, I mean, maybe they do, maybe they added it in the last week and I haven't looked. They have like pre-built like
Instagram,
Instagram, LinkedIn, yada, yada, yada. And I think that, you know, when everyone started defecting from Twitter, probably someone at Squarespace was like, are we seriously going to make a Mastodon thing? Okay. Are we serious? Threads, Hives, like there's so many. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, you know, Threads and Blue Sky seem to be the default winners at the moment.
Gotcha. All right. Well, you can find me over at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com. That's where I'm going to be all of next week. And
enjoy your flight into LA, man.
Ooh. Thanks. I appreciate that. Ben, who do we have to thank? Who made this show possible this week?
I mean, as always, we have to thank Alana Cody, who's kicking all the ass, getting us interviews and stuff. I got one in theory on Thursday for a pretty big one. I'm pretty excited about. And we got to thank Michael Indispensable Dispenza for editing all this. He's doing a great job. Hope he's staying safe in the fires. And last but never least, Case, who is safe in the fires. I have checked in on him a few times, and the fires are not especially near him, actually. Case Alatracci, who composed every bit of music that you heard on this podcast. You can find him at musicbycase.com. Please hire Kays to compose a score or something for you. He's great, and he's fun to work with, and he's really smart.
I think that's a ringing endorsement. Ben, I'm going to take us out. Thanks for tuning in.
Yay!
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.